Borders that had started to open have had to slam shut today in response to the new Omicron variant. 200,000 student and worker visa holders were going to start arriving from tomorrow, but the government has now paused that. And there's concern that low vaccination rates in some parts of the world might be making us more vulnerable to new variants. The science on that is unclear. But when we look at access to vaccines globally, what do you think is needed to make it more equitable? Chris Maher is UNICEF Australia's senior vaccine advisor. And before that, he spent over 30 years working with the WHO. Chris, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Hilary.
Could the new COVID-19 variant have been avoided if we'd been able to achieve greater vaccine equity by now, in your view?
We certainly would have reduced the possibility that we would have new variants, yes. If we could manage to immunise more people across the world, I think there's pretty wide consensus that that does significantly reduce the risk that we're going to continue to face variants that appear from time to time. The more the virus can circulate, the more likely it is that variants are going to develop. So, you know, better vaccinated populations will have less virus circulation, so less chance that you're going to have variants popping up.
Does that mean that, Chris, you would support the federal government's travel bans from affected countries? Those bans have been pretty widely criticised around the world. Just this morning we heard them described as xenophobic and discriminatory.
Travel bans are somewhat out of my area of expertise, I'm afraid, Hilary. But I am very, very supportive of the idea that the more we can do to make sure that people get vaccinated, the better off we are. I mean, it's not just a nice thing to do for other countries and other communities to make sure that they have access to vaccine. It's in our own interests as a nation to make sure that everyone in the world has equal access to the vaccine.
That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because vaccine nationalism has been quite evident in the last couple of years. Lots of rich countries, I think, pledged a lot of vaccines to poorer countries over the past 2 years. What happened to those promises?
Quite a lot of vaccine has been pledged, as you say, and quite a lot of vaccine has actually been delivered, but certainly not all of the vaccine that's been pledged has yet been provided to countries. So, I mean, the first thing that could be done by governments everywhere is to live up to the pledges that they've made already, and to make further pledges now that most rich countries are getting their people vaccinated. But even the private sector's got a role to play in this, Hillary. We've seen in a lot of parts of the world that companies and other parts of the private sector have become actively involved in donating and trying to provide support for vaccination activities. And that's a great thing for Australian enterprises to do, particularly given our interests all over the world. And even ordinary Australians can do something. You know, UNICEF has a campaign, Give the World a Shot, and you can make very small donations there, and that still has an effect and can help provide vaccines for other people.
Chris Maher, what are the main barriers to getting people vaccinated? Is this a matter of supply? Do we not have enough doses available around the world?
That's the absolute issue is vaccine supply, Hillary. There's two elements of that. One is how much vaccine can actually be made, and the second one is how much can actually be bought, because we do have to pay for this stuff. The making now is occasionally a problem as manufacturers, you know, hit their capacity, but there is quite a lot of manufacturing capacity now. So the bigger of the two issues at the moment is just having enough money to be able to buy vaccine, particularly for those countries and communities that can't afford it themselves. So supply is the biggest issue, and then you hit operational issues of how you actually manage to get vaccine out into communities and make sure that you can vaccinate people. And that's a big one too, as we discovered in Australia when we rolled out the campaigns here.
Well, and Chris, it's really interesting to see Gordon Brown, the former UK PM, writing in The Guardian this week. He's now the WHO ambassador for global health financing. And he's saying, look, we've manufactured enough vaccines now to vaccinate the entire world. We're expecting 12 billion to be manufactured by the end of the year. And there are 500,000 sitting around unused in the UK at the moment. Is this about targeted funding, targeted resources? outsourcing to get those vaccines that aren't needed to places where they are needed?
That's certainly part of it, Hillary. I mean, any country that has a surplus of vaccines now would be, you know, to me, would be a very sensible move for their own security and everyone else's security for them to be donating that vaccine and getting it out to countries that don't have enough. That's a big one. But also just the forward-looking planning for donation of funds to be able to purchase more and more vaccine as it comes online. You know, that's something that every government with enough resources to do it should be thinking about.
There's also been the suggestion that waiving intellectual property rights might be a good idea, because then you could set up manufacturing hubs in lower income countries. You wouldn't have to rely on the companies that have produced that vaccine. What's your thoughts on that? That's something that, you know, the manufacturers are resisting quite strongly.
Ultimately, establishing, you know, more manufacturing sites is a wise thing to do, because, you know, this disease is now going to be a human disease that's with us, you know, for the foreseeable future at least. So, yeah, ultimately, it's going to be great to have more vaccine supply available around the world from manufacturers in different countries. But in the short term, you know, it takes a while to establish manufacturing in different places. It's not something that you can do overnight. In the short term, the major issue is just having enough money to be able to buy vaccine for countries that can't afford it.
Chris, you mentioned too the logistics issue. How much of a challenge is the temperature-controlled supply chain that some vaccines need? Is that still proving a barrier in some places?
For most of the vaccines that are available, Hillary, the temperature storage requirements are fairly similar to the vaccines that are already in use in childhood vaccination programs and adult vaccination programs in a lot of countries around the world. So with the exception of one or two vaccines that have more stringent storage requirements, at least for part of their lives, most vaccines can be moved around and can be stored appropriately in different countries, because they've already got the expertise to do this. You know, in many places there is a need to refurbish what's called the cold chain, which is the powered and the non-powered storage processes and transport processes for vaccines. But there's also, you know, a lot of work being done by UNICEF, WHO, Gavi, and a lot of other organisations to help countries refurbish their cold chain. I don't believe that it's an insurmountable challenge to be able to store and transport vaccines in countries.
We're speaking with Chris Maher, UNICEF Australia's Senior Vaccine Advisor, here on Life Matters today. And perhaps you've got ideas about what might increase vaccine equity around the world. Chris, what impact has the pandemic had on the delivery of other vaccines, like those routine childhood vaccines, measles and polio and things like that?
In some countries, it's had a very negative impact, Hillary. We know already that tens of millions of children have missed out on any childhood vaccination, let alone every childhood vaccination that they should have received. So immunity gaps against a number of childhood illnesses are building up. Of course, this is weighted towards the lowest income countries, the countries that have the greatest difficulty in accessing their populations and in providing services, because they're less financially capable of doing it. We are seeing a situation where we really run the risk of significant epidemics of diseases like measles in the immediate future, because a lot of kids have missed out on their basic immunisation.
And Chris, you worked for over 30 years with the WHO and you focused on large vaccination campaigns for children, especially polio. Could you scale up the kinds of models that you were using for those targeted campaigns around COVID, or is it a different kettle of fish if you're trying to get that vast population-wide coverage?
There's a lot of overlap, Hillary. I mean, it is, of course, it's a different thing, because with COVID we're talking about immunising such a huge proportion of the population. So it is it's a massive challenge for anyone. Again, you know, we found that out ourselves in Australia when we were starting to do this. But in a lot of countries that have done these big campaigns against measles and huge campaigns against polio as well, you know, they've been immunising between 10 and 20% of their national population in these campaigns. So the operational challenges and the logistical challenges are something that they have dealt with in that scale. And those campaigns against measles and polio tend to be relatively short. You know, they're a week or 10 days or something like that. So they're packing in a lot of immunisation in that fairly short period of time. With COVID, we can stretch it out further. You know, we don't have to immunise 80% of the population in 10 days. We can make that a little bit of a longer time frame. And I do think that the expertise, the sort of operational capacity that countries have developed working on polio and measles campaigns comes in very, very handy when they're planning their COVID responses.
We're speaking with Chris Maher about the issue of vaccine equity, and it is a pretty stark difference when you look at the figures. The Guardian's quoting only 3% of people in low-income countries are fully vaccinated, while it's up around 60% in high-income countries and upper-middle-income countries. Chris, there is a global group that works on this, COVAX, the COVID-19 Vaccine Global Access Initiative. Why haven't they been able to be more effective in this field?
I think COVAX has been pretty effective, actually, Hillary, in terms of coordinating the distribution of the vaccines that have been available through the international community to countries that can't afford it for themselves. I think their biggest constraint has consistently been how much vaccine they actually have to be able to distribute to countries that need it. And again, that comes back to the issue of how much, what resources that have been available to be able to purchase vaccines for these countries. COVAX has managed to negotiate with manufacturers on price and done very well in agreeing prices that are much more appropriate for low-income countries. But we still face this constraint that, you know, there's only a certain amount you can do with a certain amount of money that's available. So that wealthier countries need to be giving, either donating more vaccine themselves or providing more funding to give COVAX the muscle to be able to sustainably be providing vaccines to countries.
The Lowy Institute, among others, has criticised the Australian government for targeting vaccine donations for geopolitical reasons rather than solely humanitarian reasons. And Australia's not alone in that. How did we get here, Chris Maher? I mean, don't we have obligations, human rights obligations around vaccine equity? I think the Maastricht Treaty might say something about that. Is that correct?
I wish I knew, Hillary. No, I don't. I mean, I believe there are clear, you know, moral obligations, but not just the moral obligations for us in the situation of COVID. There's a very, very clear self-interest for rich nations to make sure that everyone gets vaccinated, and we're seeing an example of that now. The more everyone gets vaccinated, the greater the control over this pandemic that we have. And leaving large parts of the world with very little access to vaccines is just, you know, waiting for a problem to happen that's going to affect us in the future. So out of pure self-interest, I believe that wealthier countries need to be quite aggressively, if you like, donating and planning to ensure that lower income countries have the vaccine they need.
Yep, interesting to see the people criticising the travel bans from Southern Africa saying, look, it's in Belgium. We haven't banned people from Belgium. It'll be really fascinating to see how this plays out. Chris Maher, thank you so much for your time this morning on Life Matters.
Thanks very much, Lori.
Chris Maher, UNICEF Australia's Senior Vaccine Advisor. Michael McKenzie, Senior Feedback Coordinator, Life Matters. What are you hearing from our listeners?
Well, Banjo has texted in saying he's spent 17 years living and working in Africa. And he says, it's a shame that once again the general population of Africa is going to pay for the billions leaders have siphoned off in corruption when it comes to those low vaccination rates. That's his perspective. Another person says, anonymous, great to see RN finally talking about vaccine equality. It has to be a conversation about both our safety and justice for people whose share of vaccines we have taken, including for boosters. These are people who have suffered generations of deprivation to grow our wealth and sense of safety. The texter says, I am so ashamed of the disdain with which we have treated Southern Africans. Stop xenophobic lockouts. Abolish intellectual property. Fund manufacturing capacity in Africa so they can get some economic gain as well. And let's meet our COVAX commitments. And we'll have more comments from both you and me a little later.
Indeed. So, Michael McKenzie, thank you.